I'm very glad to be able to welcome to the program right now the founder and editor of Counterpunch Political Newsletter and website. You can find out a special on the subject of this interview actually on counterpunch.org. Alexander Coburn wrote the book Whiteout, the CIA, Drugs, and the Press. Welcome to the program, Alexander Coburn.
Hey there. I should say quickly that I co-wrote the book with Jeffrey Sinclair, who's also the co-editor of Counterpunch.
Thank you for correcting me about that. And you've actually placed on the website a second chapter of that book, Whiteout, in honor, I imagine, of Gary Webb, who was found dead about a week ago. How the press and the CIA killed Gary Webb's career. And you start out by saying that the series that Gary Webb wrote in the San Jose Mercury News and how it was attacked in the major press remains one of the most venomous and factually inane assaults on a professional journalist's competence and living memory. That's the beginning of the story. But tell us, outline the story for us, Alexander Coburn.
Sure. Yeah, that was up on the site yesterday. Actually, in a few minutes, we'll have a column I did sort of kind of wrapping it up on poor Gary Webb for our weekend edition. Well, the story was, I imagine a lot of your audience will remember that Webb did this series called Dark Alliance on the CIA and the import of cocaine from Central America in the 80s. You'll recall that that was the Reagan years when there was a congressional ban at one point under the Boland Amendment, and they couldn't officially send money to the Contras, who were the army they were financing to try and bring down the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. And so they had to condone, the agency had to condone and connive at the transport of cocaine by the Contras to the west coast of the United States, which earned money so that they could, buy weapons and so forth. And Webb, there have been allegations of this before, and actually a probe, which was chaired by one of the not very many things, that decent things that John Kerry did in his has done in his Senate years, was chair the Contra Arms investigation in the late 80s in Congress. And that, also there were pieces by Brian Barger and Bob Parry, and also by my sister-in-law, Leslie Coburn, on CBS, making it pretty clear that the CIA and the Contras had been in cahoots on letting cocaine into the country. And Webb, who was working for the Mercury News, a straight-up journalist, did this series, three-part series, which was really very strong stuff, a lot of it based on court documents, that basically said that the huge crack cocaine epidemic in Los Angeles was a consequence of trafficking in cocaine by Nicaraguans, Contras, Blandón and Norwin Meneses, and the CIA had connived at this. And this, of course, raised huge outrage, particularly in the black communities at the time. Initially, the series didn't stir much, but then it got a lot of play on black radio, and black communities were completely outraged at the idea that the terrible crack epidemic of that time had been basically winked at and condoned by an agency of the U.S. government. The head of the CIA, John Deutsch, at the time went out and went to some rambunctious town meetings in L.A. and pledged full investigation. And then the mainstream press, particularly the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times, turned on Webb and his series, and that prompted the remark of mine and Jeffrey's that you quoted at the beginning of the show, and they trashed him very, very unfairly. They misrepresented the articles. They grossly distorted them. It was an absolutely venomous attack. But it worked to a certain extent. His own newspaper finally turned on Webb, and they reassigned him, which is what they do. They put him in the tiny office. He had to drive miles to work every day, and finally he resigned. And then he did some very good journalism after that, but it was a terrible blow for him. He loved his profession. He was from the Midwest, as a lot of really good U.S. reporters are.
Alexander Coburn, tell us what you think was the fundamental mode in which the major press attacked Gary Webb, and why? What was it about his story?
Why? Because he said the unsayable. He said that they attacked him because he was saying that a U.S. government agency had condoned the import of cocaine. There are certain things you can't say in the American press. you can't, well, you used to be able to say that the U.S. government for decades has condoned torture and has taught people how to torture, and it's been a policy of the U.S. government through the CIA. That's one you weren't meant to say until Abu Ghraib came along. You're not meant to say that the U.S. government actually assassinates people as a matter of national policy. That's a no-no. And people still say, after all these years and umpteen investigations into the attempts on Castro, they still, you'll often see alleged attempts to kill Castro. And the other one you're not meant to say is that since its inception, the CIA has been hand in glove with drug gangs and drug mafia for various reasons, actually, which we describe in our book, Whiteout. That's why they went after Webb, and the way they did it was the way they always do it. They'd say, his facts are shaky, it's an old story, these are wild allegations, he didn't connect the dots, and of course they misquoted the stories and didn't allow his publisher or him to put in factual corrections, and that's the way they did him in.
We're speaking with Alexander Coburn, who, along with Jeffrey St. Clair, edits the online political newsletter Counterpunch.org, which also has a print biweekly edition, which has been around for years, too. I'd like to take a brief look at the environment in which some of this was happening in the 1980s, when under some of those congressional hearings, there were peaks of almost insanity, when it wasn't really insanity, but things would come up such as the idea of the Federal Emergency Management Agency drawing up secret wartime contingency plans, who knows, possibly including a scheme to commandeer the Bill of Rights, although Oliver North has denied helping to draft a plan like that. Back then, the congressional Iran-Contra investigators never got to ask him about it, and a Texas representative, Jack Brooks, asked him about his work for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which is an organization that's supposed to just help people when there's a flood or a tornado. But apparently there had been some attempts to commandeer the budget of this FEMA in order to possibly, if the Central America activism in the United States got perhaps out of control, round up activists. And the Senate panel chairman at that time, Daniel Inouye, silenced that representative, Jack Brooks, and insisted that the question dealt with classified matters. And anyone might remember from watching that episode on television in the 1980s, they went into a separate room off the television cameras to discuss this. So this was the sort of strange climate in which a lot of this was happening, the idea of the Central Intelligence Agency being involved in something like condoning or conniving at allowing the Nicaraguan Contras to make money to fund their own attack against the Nicaraguan Sandinistas. As you say, the Boland Amendment had made that illegal. Alexander Coburn, just curious, did you ever meet Gary Webb?
I interviewed Gary actually in connection with the book we were doing in, it must have been either late 96 or early 97. He was a very nice fellow. It's a terrible business, him killing himself. I think he just felt he couldn't get another job on a mainstream newspaper. Maybe he had, you know, serious depression. Well, obviously something was badly wrong, and he finally blew his brains out, or so it appears. But they, I mean, the press murdered him really effectively back in '96. And everything, by the way, we should also emphasize that Deutsch, when he went to L.A. to confront these outraged town meetings, he promised this investigation by the CIA Inspector General, who was John Hitz. And Hitz's reports came out in the spring of '98 and the fall of '98. When they came out, the first volume came out in the spring, and it was immediately greeted by pieces in the New York Times and the Washington Post by Tim Weiner and Walter Pinker saying, the report exonerates the CIA. They both admitted they had actually not read the report. Anyone who read the report, which we certainly did, it's probably available somewhere online, it used to be, it actually confirmed. And the second volume, which came out in the fall, even more so, confirmed the main threads of what Gary Webb had written. But, of course, these newspapers, it's absolutely incredible when you think about it. These newspapers didn't bother to read it, except finally James Reason in the New York Times in October of 1998 did admit who'd actually been part of the attack on Webb when he was at the LA Times and has the national security beat at the Times Today. Not a very good reporter. Very bad one, actually. He admitted that the Hitz's second volume did actually confirm a lot of what Webb had said. He didn't put it like that. He just said it gave the CIA a black eye. Webb was exonerated.
And you mentioned Deutsch. You mean John Deutsch, right?
John Deutsch was the former MIT professor who became very briefly, only for a few months, actually, in 96. He was the director of the CIA. Then you'll recall he got into trouble because it turned out that he had an enormous amount of agency files, top security files, and he downloaded them onto his personal laptop. This was going on at the time when they were trying to put Wen Ho Lee away.
John Deutsch, of course, has a special resonance here around the Boston area, president of MIT for some time, and then, of course, we all know the posh little street on which he lives, where he had that little laptop with the government secrets on it. Alexander Coburn, you point out in the second chapter of Whiteout, the CIA drugs in the press, about Gary Webb and his career, particularly a raid on the office of Gary Webb's literary agent, Jody Hotchkiss, of the Sterling Lord Agency. And you say that Webb had reckoned that they were really looking for some sort of business deal between me and Ross.
It was all part of the attempt to discredit Webb. They wanted Webb. When the series took off, you know, and before they went after him big time, basically the attack on Webb was orchestrated by an assistant U.S. attorney down in San Diego called O'Neill. And he laid out the basic lines of onslaught on Webb, which were followed. And he was in close touch, O'Neill was, with people like the fellow on the Washington Post, not Pincus, who does that press stuff now. I can't remember his name. Kurtz. On the Washington Post. And he orchestrated the attacks, and they were trying to say that he basically boosted the story to make himself a bunch of money. And that somehow there were deals between Webb and Freeway Ricky Ross, who was the cocaine importer in L.A., and they were looking for dirt. They went and actually, well, the offices of Webb's agent were burglarized. Then Webb said, you know, to his paper, that his paper then got on him and said, you can't do a book. We can't have you accused of making money. I mean, think of all the New York Times reporters like Judy Miller, who made an absolute fortune out of all their monstrous lies. You know, and by the way, did stories which helped propel the book up their own newspaper's bestseller list. How about that for inside dealing? Which was Judy Miller's effort. Anyway, so Webb never really made a buck, and they didn't, of course, find anything in the agent's office. And then he wrote the book, Dark Alliance, after he'd left the paper.
I just realized maybe you're referring to the journalist along with Pincus Suro?
No, I was thinking of Howard Kurtz, actually.
Howard Kurtz, okay. I'm curious to look, too, a little more at... there were allegations that Gary Webb was committed suicide and that this is sort of only serves
I mean, the Webb has gone crazy with ideas that he might have been murdered. I think he killed himself. His former wife, who was a very nice woman, she thinks he committed suicide. He used his father's 38. There's a lot of fuss because there were two shots, but people who blow their head off, sometimes they do miss the first time and they finish themselves off the second time. It's kind of awful, but there it is. And I mean, why would they kill Gary Webb? I mean, Gary Webb was no longer like a factor in such. If someone had tried to kill him in 96 or 95, that would have been another matter. But I mean, I have to say that, you know, the amount of nonsense I get pouring into my inbox, but probably you get the same thing on.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who call themselves leftists now, they're incapable of believing things that are staring them in the face. Everything, you know, Wellstone committed was murdered, Gary Webb was murdered. I mean, face the facts. I mean, Gary Webb is a guy who probably, you know, had in his own sad way, I mean, he felt he'd come to the end of the line. I mean, I think it's terrible, and particularly from the point of view of his children, that he did it. But he'd also apparently pretty much told his family that he was likely to kill himself. So I don't think there's any mystery there. I think he did it, period.
And Al Giordano of the Narco News project and website agrees, and the points at kind of a grim determination that Gary Webb had, the kind of determination that allowed him to pull off a second gunshot into his own head. And to be.
Yeah, I mean, he reminds me in some ways, I mean, a lot of reporters come out of the Midwest, like John Quitney of the Wall Street Journal, who did some wonderful reporting. They have that same thing that I think also they genuinely believe, you know, that they genuinely believe in the national ideals. They believe in the press. And I think one of the things that really sort of, you know, was terrible for Webb was to realize that not just, you know, that the U.S. government and the CIA, you know, had you know, knowingly allowed the importation of cocaine and, you know, a devastation of poor people in the United States, but that the press, the profession he could do these things to him. It's devastating.
Alexander Cumberd, let me ask you about an article in the Washington Post you point out at that time, an essay by Fletcher on the sociology of black paranoia, and that blacks, according to this article by Fletcher, cling to beliefs regardless of, quote, the shortage of factual substantiation.
Oh, this was a whole trend in the attack on Webb, which was, see, one of the things that really worried, I think, the press and power was that the uproar in the black communities. They really felt this was, like, dangerous. And so they were particularly keen to show that Webb had somehow fired up what they kept referring to as black paranoia. There's a guy at Harvard, I don't know if he's still there, a really awful man called Poussant, Alvin Poussant. They always wheel him on. He's a professor of sociology, some kind of shrink, and he's a black fellow. And they always have him saying, you know, exactly what the white man wants him to say, which is that blacks are, you know, credulous and they too easily believe things. We have a chapter there called The Roots of Black Paranoia, showing that everything that blacks are accused of being paranoid about, they're actually right about. You know, people have said, you know, that the CIA and secret agencies have tried to devise weapons that pick on black people and only kill black people. Yes, they did. They have tested and tried to test, you know, chemical devices like that. They've looked into it.
Not only that, but the syphilis experiments you point out conducted by the U.S. government on African Americans in Tuskegee, Alabama.
Absolutely. The Tuskegee experiment is a famous example of it. You know, you can go through U.S. history and you find one thing after another totally justifying the most paranoid supposed fantasies of black people. And that was an important bit of our book. But the press at the time, on and on, the most racist, disgusting crap you've ever read in your whole life.
And this is, we should catch up for people who may not have been reading the news 20 years ago, but this was involving the allegation that crack cocaine was sold to black people, to African-American people in Los Angeles, of course, predominantly poor people, using crack cocaine in L.A., as a sort of an easy market, perhaps convenient for Nicaraguan
Contras. Well, you could go beyond that. I mean, Webb never said this. I know people who've heard people in the CIA to have a community hooked on drugs and demobilized by drugs is a lot better than having them hooked on the teachings of Malcolm X. You know, it's better to have a crackhead than a guy who's politically educating himself and trying to organize, which is, of course, what happened with the Panthers originally, although, of course, they became ultimately, you know, involved in drug dealing themselves and you know, kind of lost sight of what they were up to. But, I mean, power always likes demobilized, trashed-out communities rather than militant ones, and I think the CIA, there are people in the U.S. government, there are people in the CIA who, by the way, I've also looked into, you know, population reduction of black population. I mean, I wrote about this in The Nation. I mean, Norplant, which was the those capsules that the mothers have in their arm, which is a birth control device.
Mandatory birth control.
Yeah, you would have black women, poor women, able to have that put into their arms for nothing. But when, of course, this caused, you know, physical discomfort and all sorts of side effects, lo and behold, they couldn't get it out again. Now, if that's not population racist or class-based population control, what is? I remember writing this up in The Nation. People could barely believe it. Then you start looking at the history of sterilization in the United States, and people think, why, is he talking about Nazi Germany or America? No, you're talking about America, and you go back to the start of the century where they had sterilization policies. Hundreds of thousands of poor people were sterilized. It's all in The Legacy of Malthus, which is a fantastic book written by Alan Chase in the mid-70s. I wrote a lot about this in The Nation at one point.
And you point out in the edition published still today on counterpunch.org, this chapter, How the Press and the CIA Killed Gary Webb's Career. And you talk about how in 1997, Gary Webb was contacted by Georg Hodel, who had been in Nicaragua and had located other members of the Meneses Blandón operation who were ready to talk to Gary Webb. Gary Webb went to Nicaragua, got back to Sacramento, and was contacted by Jerry Seppos. Tell us about Jerry Seppos and the relationship with Gary Webb.
Oh, Seppos, you mean the publisher of the San Jose Mercury News?
Yes.
Well, I mean, he was the guy. But the Mercury News is owned by the Knight Ridder chain of newspapers. They own the Miami Herald. They own, I think, the Philadelphia Inquirer. They own a bunch of, actually, they were, you know, quite good second-tier papers. Seppos, and you see, initially, I don't think the people running the Mercury News quite realized what was going on. This was not, I mean, when Barger and Parry, not to mention my sister-in-law, Leslie Coburn, did all their work in the late 80s, and when Kerry was doing his probes, allegations of CIA drug contra ties were politically a very hot potato. Because, you know, at that time, the destabilization of Nicaragua was going on. By the mid-90s, it was kind of an old story. And so the piece came out, and I don't think Seppos and, you know, really, you know, a nice story by Gary Webb. And Gary Webb was, you know, a mainstream reporter, solid credentials. He'd been part of that team they had that won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the Loma Prieta earthquake. And they thought it was, you know, meat and potato stuff. They didn't realize what they were fooling with until power, real power, had to sit up and take notice because of the outrage in the black communities. At this point, no one will ever know. I mean, Seppos finally, initially he wrote strong letters defending Webb to the New York Times, which actually is, I can't remember if we ran that on the site because it was in the footnotes yesterday, but it's at the end of the second chapter in our book, which you can buy off the site, by the way. A long letter from Seppos, every line of it is a factual rebuttal of some nonsense that the New York Times has said. And the New York Times refused to publish the letter. But at some point, Seppos buckled under the pressure. My guess is that he just got called by someone in the Knight Ridder organization. Remember that newspaper chains have many irons in the fire. There's probably some city in America where they needed to get some waiver from the FCC so they could buy another radio station, or who knows what. At any rate, Seppos then... Actually, I think Webb was in Central America doing a follow-up. They wouldn't, and he'd done a follow-up to the, which actually he said, you know, confirmed more than ever what he'd done before. But they wouldn't print it, and finally he had enemies on the paper, the usual rat-outs who, you know, the people on the, and very often on these papers, it's the people on the op-ed pages who, you know, feel that they have some imagined reputation to maintain. They don't like anything that rocks the boat. And they're usually the most slavish followers of power. And they stabbed Webb in the back. And then finally, Seppos just said the paper had gone too far, had made mistakes. I mean, who knows what really happened. And Seppos himself, I think, had a heart attack at one point. And then it was all over. I mean, but you should really see Seppos as just a pawn in a big game.
Alexander Coburn, we've just about run out of time, but thank you very much for joining us today. And people can find your work and that of Jeffrey St. Clair on the website counterpunch.org. There's also an excellent political newsletter biweekly full of material that's not on the website, so people can find out about the Counterpunch original newsletter. When did you begin publishing that?
Yeah, well, actually, it was... founded initially with Ken Silverstein back in the early, who was my intern at The Nation and now is a fantastically good investigative journalist, actually working for the LA Times of all papers, doing tremendous work. And then we're in our 11th year now. What are we, 2004? I think it was 1993. And then Jeffrey came aboard in the middle 90s, and we've been at it ever since. And we have about 100,000 regular readers a day on the website. And you can buy the newsletter off the website. The newsletter, you know, is a way that the people reading our larger audience can get, you know, special material, and also a way of, you know, helping us to pay for, keep ourselves going.
Al Giordano of the Narco News Journalism Project and website pointed out, incidentally, on that note, that one of the struggles Gary Webb faced was being an independent journalist, no longer finding work at major papers, and the economic insecurity and the desperation that economic poverty can lead to. Al Giordano pointed out that he had known Gary Webb and known of his struggles to be able to finance a viable journalistic career, especially as an independent. So the point about supporting independent journalism is important.
You subscribe to Conjunct, guys. Get on with it.
Alexander Coburn, thanks for joining us, making Sounds
of
Dissent.
Good to talk to you. See you at the Copkind Colony one of these days.
There we go. You're tuned to WZBC and Newton 90.3 FM. You can find out also about a number of books published on the counterpunch.org website, including the one we were discussing today, Whiteout, and the special chapter that was featured there yesterday, and another concluding column by Alex Coburn that'll be appearing there later today, counterpunch.org. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent, WZBC in Newton. My name is John Grebe.